is a podcast from the Refugee Study Centre. To find out more, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk.
Well, thank you very much for the kind introduction. Thanks for inviting me. As Matt mentioned, I'm an economist, but I work across the economics and politics, mainly of labor immigration. Most of my work has been on comparative labor immigration policies around the world, and I've got particular interest in policy making processes. And most of my work is motivated by specific policy questions or policy dilemmas. So the previous book I did with Bridget Anderson was motivated by the question, when an employer says they need more migrant workers, how should government think about that? How should government evaluate that claim? Now, this book is motivated by the simple question, what rights should we give migrant workers after they've been admitted? So the talk is mainly about international labor migration, but why I'm particularly pleased that I can present it here as well is that in recent months, quite a few people have asked me to what extent I think the kinds of arguments that I'm making about labor migration policy also apply to other types of immigration policies, including asylum policy. So I'm looking forward to having that discussion at the end. So what I'm trying to do in the book is bring together two types of debates and two strands of literature that have, for most of the time, been living in isolation. And so on the one hand, see if this works better. On one hand, you have a lot of people working on development. Development economists argue that there should be more international labor migration globally. As many of you will know, compared to international trade and capital flows, migration is much more restricted. It's only 3% of the world's people are migrants, so are foreign-born. And the share of exports in world GDP is about 25%. The share of foreign direct investment globally in global capital stocks about the same. So because the wage differences across countries for people doing the same jobs are much larger than differences in product prices or in interest rates, returns to capital, the benefits from liberalizing labor migration are much bigger than the benefits of further liberalizing international trade and capital flows. I mean, that's a very common thing you hear development economists, trade economists make that case. So especially for low-skilled labor migration, which is most heavily restricted, there's a strong case for trying to get high-income countries to admit more migrant workers. The World Bank claims that there's no more effective strategy for raising the incomes of workers in poor countries than giving them an opportunity to work in higher-income countries. And the connection with development, of course, is more contested, the impact of migration on development of the country of origin as a whole. But it is quite clear that giving more migrants, the workers in poor countries, or more workers in poor countries, the opportunity to work in higher countries will lead to very large income gains for migrants and their families. So more migration is a good thing from that point of view. At the same time, you've had people concerned with the rights of migrants. Many UN agencies, many migrant rights advocates argue, point out that there are severe restrictions of rights around migrant rights around the world, and there should be greater equality of rights, better protection of migrant workers. International Labour Organization, in particular, Office of High Commissioner of Human Rights, have been arguing very strongly that there should be greater emphasis on migrant rights. What the book does, basically, is to say that in practice, there's a tension between these two goals, between trying to have more migration, especially low-skilled migration, and have greater equality of rights. And the argument is based on an analysis of labor immigration policies in high-income countries, i.e. on analysis of how migrant workers are admitted. And so I look at policies in over 46 countries and find a tension between what I call access and some rights, or openness and rights. So the countries that are very open to admitting migrant workers tend to be the countries that are very restrictive with regard to migrant rights. The Gulf states in the Middle East, of course, are the best example. At the other end, countries that are quite insistent on granting migrants a relatively comprehensive set of rights often don't admit very many migrant workers. Sweden, for example, is is a good example of that. So from a global justice point of view, you can argue that both more migration and more rights are good things. In practice, I argue you cannot always have both. So a choice needs to be made, a difficult choice. And that raises an interesting set of ethical questions. Most importantly, can we ever justify rights restrictions in order to have more migration? And as with all normative analysis, there's no one right answer. I'll make a particular case, a particular argument at the end. But basically, I will be saying two types of things. The one is that I think there's a tension and that we need to start discussing this tension. International organizations, especially the ILO, have been really running away from this issue or actively avoiding it. And the second argument is then if you agree that you need to engage with it, then we have to think about how do we respond to it from a normative point of view. So my work starts with this chart, which again, most of you will know. It shows you the number of ratifications of the major international human rights treaties by member states of the United Nations. And we all know that in 1990, we had a convention on the rights of migrant workers. And basically, one of the main conclusions of this chart is that the UN Convention on the Rights of Migrant Workers is by far the least ratified human rights treaty. Now, so that's interesting for a number of reasons. One is that, I mean, many lawyers argue, and I assume that's correct, that actually the Migrant Rights Convention doesn't add or doesn't create many new rights for migrant workers as such. I mean, in theory, really, you shouldn't need a Migrant Workers Convention because you've got all these human rights treaties which are supposed to apply to everybody regardless of citizenship. Okay, so really what the Migrant Workers Convention does is just emphasize that all the rights that are in here also apply to migrants. So what's interesting is that the same countries that ratify the general human rights treaties and say, yes, you know, we accept these human rights, don't ratify the 1990 Convention. So that tells me that most nation states don't accept or don't think that the human rights that are in here automatically apply to migrants as well. So we've had fewer than 50 ratifications. Most countries are, almost all countries are predominantly sending countries that have ratified this. And many of the countries that have ratified do not have very good human rights records. Again, many of you will be familiar with the literature in political science and in international law as well. On the impact of ratifying treaties on actual human rights records. So we can't always assume that just because a country ratifies a treaty that means that that country has a very good record. And some of these countries do not have very good records with human rights. So what I want to say is that the response by international organizations, especially UN organizations, migrant rights advocates to this chart has typically been to emphasize the intrinsic value of migrant rights and to say that migrant rights are human rights that should be respected regardless of citizenship. Now, the starting point of my book is that in addition to the important intrinsic value that rights have, the rights that migrants are given also play a very important instrumental role in shaping the impacts of migration for migrants, receiving countries, and sending countries. So, for example, the extent to which migrants are given social rights, so access to the welfare state, clearly has an impact on the fiscal effects of immigration for the receiving country. Whether or not migrants are given free choice of employment or restricted to specific sectors of employers impacts on their wages and remittances, and so on. So the starting point is that all rights, granting or denying all rights, creates costs and benefits, not only economic, that differ between different rights and between the short run and the long run. So rights have impacts, hence the title, The Price of Rights. There's consequences for nation states, for receiving countries, for communities. And because rights have consequences, in practice, restrictions of migrant rights are instruments of labor immigration policy and should be or need to be analyzed as such. So when I talk about labor immigration policy, I'm talking about three decisions that need to be taken by all labor immigration programs. First, how open do you want to be to labor immigration? So how do you regulate the scale of immigration? Do you have a quota? Do you let employers have as many workers as they say they need, and so on? The second question about selection: do you admit high-skilled workers only? Do you admit a mix of high-skilled and low-skilled, or do you focus on low-skilled workers? And thirdly, very importantly, what rights do you grant migrant workers after admission? So do you give them temporary permanent residence? Do you give them access to the welfare state? Do you give them family reunion rights, and so on? So my point is that these three decisions are taken at the same time when you run a labor immigration program. So that means that if you want to understand what's going on with migrant rights around the world and why and how countries restrict rights, you also have to look at admission policies, because these three things can be related in important ways. They're all part and parcel of the same overall labor immigration policy. So what I'm interested empirically in the book is that what is the relationship between these three things in practice? How do high-income countries regulate openness, selection, and rights? And what's the relationship between openness and selection? So is it the case that countries are more open to skilled and low-skilled workers? Is it the case that higher-skilled workers get more rights than low-skilled workers? And what's the relationship between openness and rights? And what I've tried to do in the book is be separate in quite a hard-nosed way between the kind of positive, or what economists call positive and normative analysis. So the positive analysis is about trying to find out what is reality, what is happening. So you know, what are the rights restrictions, what are the immigration policies, and what drives them, and what are the relationships? And then the normative analysis is trying to say, well, what should be the case? And normatively, given this reality, what should we be trying to do? And it's quite important to separate the two, I think. Many people mix them up, which is really quite unhelpful. So just to be clear, I'm going to, before I talk about implications for asylum and refugee policies at the end, I'm primarily concerned about labor immigration policy. By that I mean policies for admitting migrants for the primary purpose of employment. There's lots of other policies that bring in migrants who end up in the labor market and who are migrant workers. I'm not concerned with those. When I talk about rights and labor immigration policies, I'm always talking about policies and rights on paper or in law. Okay? So in my empirical analysis, we're measuring rights as they are in legal texts or in regulations, and restrictions on immigrations as they are in law, again, or in regulations. So not in practice. Now, of course, there can be a big gap between rights in law and rights in practice. But measuring rights in practice, I think, is important, but is a different level of complexity and almost inevitably involves a large degree of judgment. But just to point out the obvious, that the gap can go either way, in a way. So I think we often think about legal rights existing in law but not in practice. So migrants might have the right to join trade union in law, but then in practice the trade union might not allow the migrant to join. Okay, but it might also go the other way. So many governments some governments are trying to exclude particular types of migrants from access to, say, the health service or schools. But when the children, you know, show up at school, or when people show up at a hospital, the doctor does not refuse treatment, or the school teacher does not refuse to teach the child. So the rights in practice could go beyond the rights in law, so it's quite, I think, important. I'm also primarily only concerned with legal labor migration flows and policy. So there's whole groups excluded, and it's an important question about how to exclude the groups in a way relate to what I'm saying, and we can discuss that at the end. So again, I'm interested in the relationship between openness, selection, and rights. And if we want to come up with hypotheses about that relationship, so you can ask the question, what does theory tell us? Is there anything that we can use to come up with expectations? Now, if you want to come up with hypotheses, you need some sort of a conceptual approach to the policy-making process. You need to say, well, how is policy made in high-income countries? What are the drivers? And there is, of course, a lot of disagreement in the literature. There's lots of different models. Some people say it's labor immigration policy is based purely on interest groups, so the Gary Freeman model, which sees no independent role for the nation-state except that of an arbiter between trade unions and employers who argue with each other. Employers are stronger, they win, you have liberal immigration policy. So the nation state in that model has no national policy objectives at all. There's no agency for the state. Okay. Now, different approaches emphasize institutions. So Kitty Kalavita's work on the U.S. Bracero program, for example, and many other scholars have looked at how the state works in practice, and these approaches point out often there's contradictions and inconsistencies. Which is patently true in most countries. In the UK, there's an open battle between the Home Office and BIS about labour immigration policy. The Home Office wants fewer migrants, especially including fewer students. BIS wants more students. So, you know, it's not always coherent. So what I've done here is to take quite a crude national interest approach and quite a functional approach to conceptualizing the labor immigration policy process. So I argue that nation states do have a considerable degree of agency. That means that they are in a position to formulate objectives, national policy objectives. And I argue basically that the decisions on openness, election rights is a process of choice under constraints. So nation states are deciding on openness, election and rights on their labor immigration policy based on a series of objectives and given a series of constraints. And I'm just going to talk about it very briefly, because again, we can talk about more detail later. But so what are the objectives of immigration policy? Well, typically, I argue there's four types of objectives. One is to do with economic efficiency or economic growth. So most countries talk about how can we make migration benefit the economy. A second one is about distribution. Few countries can get away with running their immigration policy without any reference to impacts on low-income earners. So generally, there is an objective of trying to protect the national labor market, especially low-income earners, to some extent. Of course, there's big debates about impact of immigration on national identity and social cohesion, and on public order and national security and crime. Now, how these things are defined in different countries varies. What I'm saying here is that these themes feature in all immigration debates. The importance assigned to each of these things differs across countries and over time. So, for example, during economic growth, distributional concern might be much less than during economic downturn. But all states think about this when they decide on their policies. So what are the constraints? Well, obviously, no country is in complete control of immigration. There's a capacity constraint. There's big literature. Doug Massey and others have written a lot about this. The capacity to control immigration varies across countries, depends on many things, geographic characteristics, the strength of your bureaucracy, and so on. There's obviously a liberal constraint. That means domestic liberal institutions, including courts, constitutions. International commitments prevent countries from choosing any level of openness, election rights. So governments are not completely free to pick any policy they want. They're constrained to some extent. And of course, the important institutional variation. So political systems make a difference. So if you're not a liberal democracy, you can take different policy decisions than a liberal democracy. So Kuwait can run its immigration policy in a way that's fundamentally different from Britain, precisely because it's not a democracy. Production regimes matter. Whether or not you have a liberal or regulated labor market matters on the kinds of choices you make, and the type of welfare state you have also matters. So what I'm saying is that labor immigration policy is a process of choice under constraints. State decide and open the selection rights based on objectives, which are variable, and constraints, and binding in the short term at least. So because variations and constraints define and circumscribe the policy space for the regulation of labor immigration, this policy space varies across countries. Okay, different constraints in different countries. So Kuwait, Sweden, UK have different constraints arising from different institutions, labor market, welfare, stable systems, and that means there's different policy spaces. But all countries have some space for regulating these things. Okay, if you think this kind of framework is completely ridiculous, which is a legitimate argument, all I will say is that the empirical results that I'll show in just a second are independent, of course, of the theory. I need my theory to come up with hypotheses, and I need my theory to try to explain the empirical findings. But I think it's perfectly possible to disagree with this and say this is not really how policy works at all. But you can still, or I hope you can still engage with the empirics of it. So based on this kind of theoretical model, there's three expectations that I have. One is that high-income countries are going to be more open to skilled and low-skilled workers. So if you look at what we know about the economic and other effects of immigration on receiving countries, I defined receiving countries in quite a narrow way, the national interest of these countries, of the people who are already there, of the existing population, you expect them to be more open to skilled and low-skilled because skilled workers generate greater complementarities with the existing skills and capital of residents. There's greater externalities and spillover effects. We often hear about the dynamic effects, dynamic benefits from immigration. Almost always these stories involve high-skilled migrants. So the Indian doctor working with the British doctor, when they work together, there's all kinds of synergies, positive effects, ideas that are good for economic growth. So you very rarely hear that about low-skilled migration. The fiscal effects of immigration of high-skilled workers are obviously more beneficial than low-skilled workers. In a progressive taxation system, high-skilled workers, including high-skilled citizens, pay more taxes than low-skilled workers and make fewer demands on the welfare state. Now, because rights create costs and benefits, and because of this, the costs vary across skill levels, again, take social rights, granting a high-waged migrant worker access to social housing is going to create fewer costs than granting a low-waged migrant access to social housing or low-income support, for example. Because rights, the costs of rights vary by skill, we can expect high-skilled migrants to be given more rights than lower-skilled migrants. And if you accept that some rights create net costs in the short run for the receiving country, for example, access to social housing, again, in Britain, social housing stock in the short run is fixed, essentially, so giving more people access to it creates some immediate costs, immediate consequences. If you accept it as some net costs, then I think the extent to which countries are willing to admit migrants will depend on the degree to which they can restrict these rights. So that's where you get the trade-off between some costly rights and openness. Now, everything I've just said applies to most migrants, but not the most highly skilled migrants. And that's because there's a fundamental asymmetry in global markets for high-skilled and low-skilled migrant workers. Now, so for high-skilled migrant workers, there's a relatively large number of countries competing for a relatively small number of high-skilled workers. So that means there's a race to the top in terms of wages and rights. So in order to attract the high-skilled, I don't know, Indian worker or a Singaporean worker to a particular country, you have to offer very comprehensive rights because these high-skilled migrants have a choice of a lot of countries. And they choose based on lots of things, wages, but also rights. So when Germany tried to attract high-skilled migrant IT workers in the early 2000s, and it wasn't very successful, one of the big reasons for that was that Germany did not offer sufficiently good rights, including not a good access to citizenship. So for that kind of high-end market, it's kind of a biased market in a way. So it's the migrants who are in control. But for the rest, high-income countries are facing an unlimited supply, essentially, of workers from low-income countries who would like to get access, regardless, more or less, of the rights on offer. The best case is the Middle East, where millions of workers go voluntarily and work under severely restricted rights. So anyway, these are the expectations I had. So the empirics is trying to find out whether that applies in practice and what are the kind of key features of immigration policies. The main problem I had, of course, with this work is there was no data whatsoever to do this, because even though there's quite a few competitiveness indices out there, trade competitiveness indices out there, labor market flexibility indices, there's nothing on immigration policies. And this is slowly changing now, but there was nothing readily available that would tell me how open different countries are to admitting migrant workers. And similarly, there's a kind of growing industry that measures human rights, Freedom House indices, there's Terror Scale indices, but there's nothing at the moment. There's no global database of the legal rights of migrant workers. So again, we had to come up with our own indices. So we created our own indices with a team of excellent researchers, including Agnieszka in the back, so she can tell you all about the process. And what I'm going to show you is two separate measures. So we created two indices. One measured the openness of labor immigration programs in high-income countries to admitting migrant workers. So how restrictive are these programs in terms of the openness, in terms of the scale? Okay. And the second set of indicators was concerned with measuring the legal rights that migrants are given after admission under these programs. Okay. And because I'm also concerned about the skill level, each labor immigration program was assigned a targeted skill level. So we covered 46 countries with a population of greater than 2 million, all high-income countries and some middle-income countries. And so each labor immigration program was given a targeted skill level. So no, this is arbitrary how you define this because there's no readily accepted definition of what's skilled and low-skilled. So we just said low-skilled is less than high school, skilled if you have high school, high-skilled the first degree, high-skilled two, second degree. So we looked at 104 labor immigration programs in 46 countries. We have our 12 indicators for openness and our 23 indicators for legal rights, and we scored all these indicators across the 104 countries in all the 104 programs in all these countries for both 2008 and 2009. And what I'm going to show you now is the results for 2009. We also checked 2008 because of the economic downturn. There's a concern that might have made a difference. Turns out it didn't. Policies didn't change very much at all, at least. So importantly, we're excluding large numbers of migrants. We're excluding people who are students, asylum seekers, family, self-employed. And importantly, in the EU, we're only measuring policies toward third country nationals. So we're only capturing immigration policies for non-EU nationals. And we can have a discussion about what the exclusion of free movement migration implies and why we've done that. So the only bit of notation that you need to understand and remember when you look at some of the charts in a minute is this in the first row. So we have 104 labor immigration programs. Only LS means labor immigration programs that are targeting low-skilled migrant workers only. So these are programs specifically designed to attract low-skilled workers only. LS means programs for low-skilled and maybe others, medium-skilled, high-skilled 1, high-skilled 2. Only HS2 are policies that are specifically designed to attract the most highly skilled workers only. The way that we use this slightly cumbersome way of describing this is that in practice, of course, we know there's a mismatch between the skills of migrants and the work they do. So you can't simply say it's the low-skilled migrants or the high-skilled migrants, because programs that target low-skilled workers might end up getting a lot of high-skilled workers doing low-skilled jobs. Okay? So it's about targeting. And again, there's an element of subjective assessment in there, of course. So we have, you see here the numbers of the 17, only low-skill, 46 low-skill policies, moving to the right, 104 policies in total. Indicators, again, I won't spend too long on this, but we can. I'm very happy to discuss this in detail in the discussion. I have 12 indicators. We have 12 indicators for measuring how open labor immigration programs are. So the key thing to remember is the unit of analysis here is not countries as a whole. The unit of analysis is labor immigration programs within countries. Why? Because most countries, with the notable exception of Sweden, have more than one labor immigration program for admitting different types of workers. So the US has 6 at the moment, at least 6 labor immigration programs for admitting low, medium, high-skilled migrant workers. The UK has at least 2, tier 1, tier 2, and lots of other countries have varying numbers. And how openness and rights are regulated varies significantly, as I will show, across different skill levels. So I'm looking at labor immigration programs. So for openness, I'm looking at whether or not there's a quota, a numerical limit, what type, and how big that quota is relative to population, what demand restrictions are there. So these are restrictions on employers. What requirements are made of employers to get access to migrant workers? So is a job offer required? Is there a labor market test? Do employers have to show that there's no domestic workers available to do the job? Is migration limited to specific sex occupations? Does the government interfere with the wages that migrants need to be paid? So, for example, in Sweden, the government tells employers you have to pay migrants collectively agreed wages in Sweden. That's not the case in flexible labor markets like the UK. And there's supply restrictions. By that, I mean characteristics of migrants. So do the nationality and age of migrant make a difference in terms of the likelihood of being accepted to the country? Are there host country language skills requirements? Self-sufficiency requirements, do migrants have to show that they're not going to be a burden on the welfare state and so on. Okay, so these are 12 indicators, which are each scored and then aggregated. And on migrant rights, we're looking at 23 legal rights, including a mix of civil and political rights, economic rights, social rights. Now, all measures are normalized. So all the numbers you will see are between 0 and 1. So for the openness indicator, 0 means that there's a lot of restriction. It's a relatively closed program. 1 means it's relatively open. So the greater the number, the more open the labor immigration programs. For rights, 0 means that right or that set of rights is quite restricted. 1 means that there's equality of rights with citizens. Okay? So it's always between 0 and 1. And again, we had a team of excellent research assistants who spent a good bit of time doing this work, checking and cross-checking. And I mean, what I will say, I mean, for any of you who've created your own data set, you inevitably always become somewhat insecure about its quality. The advantage of working with somebody else's data is always you don't know what's gone into the process of collecting the data. So there's undoubtedly measurement error. The main constraint has been that we did this with a team of research assistants from Oxford, based in Oxford. So we kind of looked at the laws in other countries to try to find out what is going on. I think an improved version of this would involve country experts who are actually in the countries. So there's clearly some measurement error, but I'm quite bullish about the quality of the data in a sense. I think it's the best data set out there, and I am confident that it's good enough to kind of study the broad relationships that we're interested in. Initially, we had more than 46 countries, but we included some countries where we just couldn't get good enough information, including South Africa and Russia, for example. So we can have a debate about normalization and what weights you put on each indicator. I had equal weights because there was no compelling argument for giving more importance to one indicator over another. Again, we can discuss that. Okay, we've finished all the methods now, so here are some results. So I'm going to show you some key features of labor migration policies in high-income countries, and I'm going to focus on the three relationships that I was expecting, I was interested in. So the first point, some of the things that I'm going to show are things that are known, which is very reassuring, because you know whenever you have a new data set, you do want to partly show what we think we know already, so you get some reassurance that the data set is not completely off. The first point to make is that over 90% of labor migration programs in high-income countries are guest worker programs. Are temporary migration programs. So I define a temporary migration program as a program that gives temporary residence and work permits on arrival. Some of these programs grant permanent residence after some time, but the great majority of programs are temporary migration programs. So there's a big literature about the demise of guest worker programs and the demise. Well, that's just not true. Generally speaking, when you talk about labor migration policy in high-income countries, you're talking about temporary migration programs. The permanent migration programs in purple here are really limited to the more higher skilled, to programs that target more higher skilled migrants. So their share increases, and the higher the skill level targeted, the more likely that there will be a permanent migration program. What's interesting here is that even among policies that are specifically designed to attract the most highly skilled, the majority are temporary. Okay? So mainly we're talking about temporary migration programs. This is just a spider diagram. I'll just explain to you quickly how this works. So this shows you the different dimensions of regulating openness, you know, through a quota, job offer. The closer you are to the origin, zero is here, and one is in the outer rim, is one. So the closer the line is to zero, the more restriction. Okay, the closer you are to one, the less restriction. So what this tells you is that most labor migration is regulated through quotas and demand-side restrictions, because this is where we are closest. Supply-side restrictions, very few countries use, except, of course, as we all know, traditional settlement countries that use points-based systems. Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, in their points-based systems, pay attention to the characteristics of migrants and not only to the requirements of employers and quotas. So most labor migration is regulated through quotas and things like job offer requirements, labor market test. On the first hypothesis, there's very strong evidence that labor migration programs that target higher skilled migrants, so the ones to the right, are more open than to admitting migrants than those to target lower skilled migrants. So I measure openness here. Remember, the higher the number, the greater the openness. There's a positive relationship between openness and skill level. You get more highly skilled as you move to the right. And if you focus on upper high-income countries only, the relationship is even stronger. I mean, again, this is not surprising, but there are very few exceptions to this pattern. But there are important exceptions. And actually, interestingly, one is the US, one is Sweden, and the other one is the Gulf States. And again, we can discuss about why these countries are exceptional. Now, in terms of rights, this is a diagram that is, again, reassuring, because it confirms something that we knew already from more qualitative case study approaches. So this shows you the restrictions on different dimensions of rights that migrant workers are given under these migration programs by region of the world. And again, the closer you are to zero, that means the more restriction there is on that particular set of rights. So what's the region, where are the labor immigration programs that restrict rights most heavily? Well, it's this blue, light blue line. So these are the GCC countries, so the Gulf states. Okay? So the Gulf states are most restrictive in terms of all dimensions of migrant rights, followed by Southeast Asia. Again, we know this. I mean, you know, countries Singapore, Malaysia, impose some very draconian restrictions on the rights of migrant workers. Many of you will know in Singapore, if you're a low-skilled migrant worker, you're not allowed to get married to a Singaporean citizen resident, actually. You're not allowed to cohabit with a Singaporean resident. And if you're a female low-skilled migrant worker, you have to undergo mandatory pregnancy checks every six months. So very, very basic restrictions of kind of basic human rights. Now, what's the relationship between rights and skills? Again, it is, as I expected, for all types of rights except political rights. So here I measure the restrictions on rights. The closer you are to zero, the more restrictions. Closer to one means equality of rights. So the rights basically increase, again, with skill level targeted, except for political rights. And that's not surprising, because the story I'm telling, or I'm trying, the causal story I'm telling here, that this is because of basically countries doing cost-benefit analysis and restricting rights because they think it's costly to grant these rights, or more costly to grant these rights to lower-skilled migrant workers. Now, most but not all countries that I look at, the liberal democracies, that would find it very difficult to make that kind of argument for civil and political rights. Okay, so it's very, you don't hear very often that it's very expensive to protect the right of free speech and therefore we don't grant it. But you hear all the time that it's very expensive to grant low-skilled migrants access to the welfare state and therefore we restrict this access. Okay, so so you have positive relationships for most rights under these programs. And finally, when you correlate openness and rights, this is what you get. So these are simple correlation coefficients. So this measures the relationship. What's the relationship between openness and legal rights grant after admission for different types of rights and for different programs across skill? So what I'm showing you here are the correlation coefficients that are statistically significant and all that are statistically significant. So the only ones that are statistically significant have a negative sign indicating an inverse relationship. Now what's important is that when you dig deeper, that in practice, the trade-off only applies to a few specific rights. And that makes sense. So it's not all social rights that are affected by the trade-off with openness. It's a few specific rights that are perceived to create net costs for receiving countries. So it's important to emphasize that. In most cases, in the story that I'm telling, it will be in the interest of the receiving country to grant the right. So for example, in the labor market, in order to achieve the objective of protecting the lowest income earners, you want to grant migrants near equality of rights in the labor market because you don't want migrants to compete unfairly because they have reduced rights. Employers prefer them because they have fewer rights. So in most cases, there's a strong argument, a national interest argument, for granting rights, but not in all. And this is how the trade-off arises. Now, I think this kind of quantitative analysis is quite interesting, but it obviously has its limits. And so there's kind of in-depth series of mini in-depth studies as well. I mean, there's many, many examples of this trade-off in practice in labor immigration policy making. I'll just give you maybe the first one. In the US, in the early 1990s, there was a lot of concern about the fiscal effects of low-skilled immigration. And President Clinton created the Jordan Commission to advise on immigration policy. And the commission basically advised Congress to maintain migrants' access to the American welfare state, but to reduce the scale of immigration, reduce numbers. Congress turned around and did exactly the opposite, and they cut access to the welfare state, but kept numbers high. Okay, that was the way it was. This policy was sold and talked about was immigration, yes; welfare, no. And I think there's lots of other examples of labor immigration policies where you can see the trade-off at work, and very explicitly at work. Now, I've spent five, six more minutes. Talk about this before I conclude with some discussion, some thoughts about asylum and refugees. So how shall, if we accept now that there is a trade-off between some rights and openness, how shall we think about this normatively? Well, as I said at the beginning, different people will have different views and there's no one right answer. However, I would say that anybody who thinks about this normatively, I hope, would consider the interests of migrants in sending countries, at least the choices and policies of sending countries, as well as the actions of migrants. So when you look at the labor emigration policies of the major sending countries, you see that there's typically two policy objectives. There's one, you send workers out, more workers out for remittances, and the second one is to protect migrants while abroad. So if you look at the policy of Bangladesh, of Sri Lanka, of Indonesia, of the Philippines, of Latin American countries sending workers to the US and Canada, it's always there. We want to have more labor immigration, promotion of labor immigration. At the same time, we want to protect rights of our nationals abroad. When push comes to shove, the rights protection objective is always second to the objective of sending workers out. Okay, so the best example recently is you will have heard about the kind of exploitation of Nepali workers in Qatar working on World Cup stadiums there. What happened? Qatar and Nepal gave a joint press conference, the governments, saying that there's no problem. Nepal said, what the Guardian is on about, that's all, you know, our workers are fine. Now, why would Nepal say that? Well, you know, Nepal is very concerned that Qatar, if it becomes too insistent on equality of rights, Qatar will just turn around and say, fine, you know, we'll just take our workers from elsewhere. And that happened in countless cases. There's over the years, many instances of terrible abuse of domestic workers from Indonesia and Saudi Arabia. And what did Indonesia do? Well, they imposed export, what they call export bans. So Indonesia said to Saudi Arabia, if you don't treat our workers better, we just won't send any more domestic workers. And Saudi Arabia said, fine, we'll just take them from Bangladesh. And Indonesia said, okay, we'll drop our export ban again. So there's a real, I think, dilemma that sending countries face. There is examples, quite a few examples, of sending countries that explicitly do not want equality of rights of the nationals abroad, arguing that this is protectionist policy. So, for example, when many of you will have heard about the Laval case in Sweden, the Latvian construction company taking its Latvian workers to Stockholm to build a primary school, and the Swedish trade unions demanding that these workers be paid collectively agreed wages in Sweden, the Latvian company paid them less, and there was a big court case, and all of that. So from the Swedish point of view, the demand for equal treatment was justified by reference to equality and inclusion. Okay? Now, from the Latvian point of view, it was a blatant argument for protectionism. It was basically saying, you want to keep us out, you don't want us to work in your country, and how do you restrict us? You tell us that, you know, we have to offer the same prices and the same wages as you do. So all the East European countries basically sided with Latvia. Interestingly, all East European countries plus Britain sided with Latvia, saying that, yes, the wages that need to apply are not those of the receiving country. Whereas the old EU member states were all saying, no, the wages and conditions that should apply are those in our countries. So, one person's argument for inclusion, equality of rights, or another person's argument about protectionism. So, ethics in one page. There's a whole chapter on it. But basically, what I'm arguing is that, as I've said repeatedly, there's no one right answer to this because different people will take different approaches. I'm taking a very pragmatic and real, what I call a realistic approach, which accepts the existence of nation states, which accepts that nation states have to give preference, at least some preference, to the interests of their own citizens over people in other countries. And I say there's a very strong argument for trying to liberalize low-skilled labor migration around the world through temporary migration programs that restrict a few specific rights that create net costs for receiving countries and that therefore obstacles to more open admission policies. So I list the specific rights restrictions which I find acceptable, and we can discuss those. And I say specifically that I only find these restrictions acceptable on a temporary basis. Now, how many years? So this is basically following Joseph Cairns and maybe many others who argue that claims increase over time, and there's somewhat arbitrary how many years that should be. But I think after, say, 4 or 5 years, countries need to make a choice. Either make your temporary migrants permanent, or you ask them to leave. What I would find unacceptable is a permanent second-class status, as we see it very often in the Gulf states. So if you don't like temporary migration programs for low-skilled migrant workers, I think normatively you have to convince me and anybody else that the realistic alternatives are superior. And I don't think that's the case. So what are the realistic alternatives to low-skilled labor migration programs for in high-income countries? Well, one is exclusion, which means migrant workers are not admitted at all. Another is illegal immigration. There's a third alternative, which is permanent migration programs for low-skilled migrant workers. Now, I don't think that is realistic. I don't think it's realistic to expect high-income countries to start creating permanent migration programs for increasing numbers of low-skilled migrant workers. So if you don't like a temporary migration program for low-skilled workers, I think what you will end up with, either exclusion, migrants don't get admitted at all, or illegal immigration. And from all the work I've done, at least with kind of migrants and sending countries over the years, I have not seen any evidence that that's what sending countries or migrants want. And migrants don't benefit from Sweden's very inclusive migrant rights policies if they're not admitted to Sweden. So I'm concerned with trying to enable more workers in low-income countries to access higher-income countries. And I think the price that needs to be paid is some of these temporary restrictions. So to bring it back, in a way, to the human rights, I think some of these human rights approaches suffer from a blind spot in the sense that they're primarily concerned about protecting existing migrants without thinking about the consequences for the admission of new migrant workers. So crudely put, insisting on equality of rights for new migrant workers can come at the price of more restrictive admission policies. And most UN agencies, and particularly the ILO, which I wish to single out, have been very reluctant and in some cases possibly hostile to engaging with this tension. And I think it's a real dilemma, because no matter what global governance debate on migration you look at, you always have these objectives there. You always have the objective of protecting rights and having more migration, especially World Bank. And nobody ever talks about the tension between these two. And so the specific policy argument that I make is that I think after 25 years of 1990 UN Convention, we have to think about a new approach, a complementary approach. And what I suggest is that we start thinking about a universal list of core rights for migrant workers that includes fewer rights than the 1990 Convention, but as a consequence has a greater chance of being ratified by more countries, including countries that admit large numbers of migrant workers. And there is a precedent for this. In the late 1990s, of course, the ILO did introduce core labor standards for precisely the same reason. There was a concern that ILO conventions weren't being ratified enough, and therefore we should have a push for a few specific, very important fundamental rights, that these need to be protected. And I'm suggesting something similar needs to happen with labor migration. I promise to finish on asylum and refugees. And so the question is, to what extent, I've been asked recently, does this trade-off between openness and rights also apply to asylum policies? Now, initially when I wrote the book, it was very clear is that I don't expect this to apply to asylum policies, for the simple reason that in the spirit of asylum policy, of course, is that it's not supposed to be about economics. I mean, policies are not supposed to be driven by considerations of costs and benefits. Now, that's very different with labor immigration policies. With labor immigration policies, there's no widely accepted normative reason or humanitarian reason of why you should admit large numbers, unless it's in the interest of a receiving country. With asylum, of course, it's supposed to be about driven by humanitarian considerations. Now, having said that, of course, you could argue that in practice, many receiving countries are running their asylum policies based on a wide range of considerations, including economic cost benefit. So you could argue that the reason why I find that Sweden has such a restrictive labor immigration policy is because Sweden runs a very liberal asylum and humanitarian policy for asylum seekers. So you could argue, well, maybe Sweden gets all its workers through its humanitarian policies. So what this points to is that a limitation of my approach is that I quite narrowly look at only one set of policies. So there might be important interactions between labor immigration policies that I've analyzed and other types of policies. So if you think that, if you take this kind of realistic approach to asylum policy, I think one thing that one might expect is that, I understand that, you know, some countries make a distinction between temporary and permanent protection of asylum seekers. So you could think about situations where there's very large inflows of asylum seekers, where in these situations you will find fewer rights, i.e. you find temporary protection policies. Whereas the countries that grant kind of permanent protection, where these are the countries that are actually accepting fewer refugees. So that's one of the I think questions that I think would be quite interesting to look at empirically. I haven't seen any convincing work on this. I think there have been a few people who have looked at this, including at the LSE in London, but I don't think the indicators they've used quite capture the openness rights trade-off that I've been talking about. I've spoken for a little bit too long. I'm sorry about that, but I'll finish now. Thank you.
For more information about the different ways you can stay updated and engaged with the work of the Refugee Study Centre, please visit www.rsc.ox.ac.uk/resources/connect.